Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, your host. We are broadcasting live from bbsradio.com on this Saturday, January the 14th, 2012. It is also the 22nd day of the first moon in the first year. I have decided to move away from the Gregorian calendar, and so I want to acknowledge that with this first broadcast in the first moon. I am very grateful and honored to be welcoming to the Alchemy of Light broadcast two people who have extraordinary intelligence and messages for humanity at this auspicious time in our birthing. And Alchemy of Light is a celebration and exploration of consciousness, because everything begins with a thought or a feeling, actually a feeling. So how do y'all feel about the upcoming elections, and how do you all feel about the person we call Barack Obama? You know, how we feel about things is key to our guiding intelligence and understanding the correct questions to ask and the ways to pursue information that is becoming available to us. So we have two people who are here presenting the Obama-Mars connection to us. Andrew Bashago is an extraordinary person who was part of a program called Project Pegasus as a child, and which was a DARPA program, a Defense Advanced Research Project Agency program, in which they basically explored many Tesla technologies, tapping the zero point, which included time travel, teleportation, etc. And some years later was part of the Mars program, where he encountered Barack Obama, who was then called Barry Sortoro. He is going to bring to us today a sharing of his testimony of what happened there at that time. Alfred Weber is another extraordinary person. He brought to me the birthing of exopolitics in my consciousness, and the exopolitical connection is absolutely key to understanding any of this parent madness in the world. Without the extraterrestrial connection, we're just going to be spinning our wheels and wondering the same questions. But Alfred Weber has pioneered many bold and brave new realms of consciousness for us to enhance our experience as human beings. So, they are going to be talking about a public event that is scheduled next week in Rainier, Washington. I'm going to hand them the talking stick and let them go with this. Please welcome Andrew Bashago and Alfred Weber. Hello, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi there, Jamil.
You know, I would like to turn the talking stick over to Andy, because the title of our talk, which relates to your question of how do you feel about the 2012 election, you know, which is part of the overarching question that you asked. The title of our talk is Unraveling the Obama-Mars Connection, which actually does relate to how, you know, who is this individual that is in the White House, which is part of the body politic of the United States. And Andy actually met this individual starting in 1980. So I really want to turn the talking stick over to him first. Andy.
Thank you, Alfred. Well, in the summer of 1980, I was 18. I had served in Project Pegasus between age 7 and 11, from the 1967-68 time frame until 1972. And then my family had moved to Southern California. I had a very conventional junior high school period. But after a year of college at UC San Diego, I put in a transfer to UCLA for the fall. My late father, Raymond F. Bashago, who was a special projects engineer for the Ralph M. Parsons Company, and back during the Project Pegasus days, he'd essentially been the the liaison, the chief technical consultant between Parsons and the CIA on theory and practice of teleportation. Parsons, of course, being one of the largest, well, the largest engineering company in the world, and a principal defense contractor that had been closely involved in defense work going back to Ralph M. Parsons' founding of the company in the late 1940s after World War II. And my dad informed me that we were going to be going camping. I had camped with my family from age three, let's say summer of 1965, through to the previous summer. Of course, with my older siblings leaving the nest and then sort of leaving their camping group. So the previous several summers, I had camped with my mother and father and my next eldest brother. But my dad approached us approached me in our home in Southern California and informed me that he was taking me camping just in a kind of a father and son trip. And so the next Saturday, we loaded up our station wagon and our boat, and we towed our boat from our home in Chatsworth, California, up to where my dad told us we would be camping, which was on the northern shore of Lake Siskiyou, very close to Mount Shasta. And we drove the considerable distance between Chatsworth and Shasta. But before reaching the campground, he exited exit 745, which is the linkage from the I-5 corridor to McLeod, California. He parked the car in the parking lot of the McLeod Market. And before leaving the car, he said, "Son, stay in the car. I'm going to be gone for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then I'll return, but whatever you do, unless there's a problem with the car, don't leave the vehicle." So he did as he said. He went into the McLeod Market. He came out about 20 minutes later, but I immediately noticed that he had a 5-day growth of beard. And having been a child participant in the early days of time-space exploration by the U.S. government, basically not just really developing, but operationalizing the use of time travel technologies within the defense and intelligence communities, I suddenly realized that my dad had just been somewhere else for a number of days. He had a black beard. He had white hair by then. My dad was of a Polish bloodline that the individuals tended to actually have black hair. And so my dad had black hair in his earlier days, very handsome man, and his beard was still going black, so I could clearly tell that he returned to the car with a lot, with growth of beard that he simply did not have when he entered the store. He'd been clean-shaven when he entered the McLeod Market. So I said, "Dad, where did you go?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You grew a beard." And he said, "Oh, no, I didn't, son. You know that whenever we go camping, I let my beard grow." And I said, "Oh, come on, Dad. You went somewhere." And then he just kind of clammed up. Well, in the early part of 2010, another individual who was part of my summer experiences stepped forward and described how when he was 13 at that time, that summer of 1980, his father approached him with the same story. "Son, we're going to be going camping this summer as father and son, not with your mom or sister, up in Shasta." And that individual was William B. Stillings, who we called Brent. And Brent was approached by his father, Thomas J. Stillings, who was then an operations analyst for Lockheed in Burbank, California. That's the Lockheed Skunk Works. In fact, Brent showed me his father's skunk pin, lapel pin, which was the logo of the Lockheed Skunk Works from those years of employment. He later went on to work for NASA, JPL, in Pasadena. So the Stillings were residing then in La Cañada, California, immediately adjacent to Parsons and NASA, JPL, and Caltech, and so forth. And Brent describes an identical incident that before going up to the northern shore of Lake Siskiyou and encountering my father and I in the adjacent campsite, his father shaved in the car and then walked into the McLeod Market and came out with about a 3-day growth of beard, despite the fact that apparently 20 minutes earlier he had just shaved. So we've concluded that there was some access point either under or behind the McLeod Market, or even maybe in it, that allowed our fathers to either enter the underground location beneath Mount Shasta or teleport from that location somewhere, where they participated in some kind of briefing of some kind of multi-day conference about what was going to transpire that summer. We then were taken separately. We hadn't met yet. We were introduced as friends up at the campsite. I remember arriving and setting up our tent, and then a couple hours later, Brett and his father appeared in their distinctively pumpkin-colored camper, their minivan. And later that afternoon, Brett and his father came over to our campsite. Brett introduced us. During that day, he showed Brett and I a piece of what he described as boundary layer material, which was a slab of thin metal. It looked sort of like a fragment of aluminum that was considerably weathered. And he showed us how it basically hovered 3 inches off the ground. So I guess that was an attempt to immerse us in science or just start thinking about, maybe start psychologically preparing us for the notion that the summer was going to hold some introduction to material in science that would be quite astonishing. We then pretty much just conversed for the rest of the afternoon. We had dinner at the picnic table there. And then just a conventional time around the campfire. However, the next day, this Sunday, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, our fathers just spontaneously stood up from the camp and began walking over to an adjacent campsite. We walked between the two vehicles that were parked in front of the campsite, kind of blocking the campsite, and we were greeted between the two vehicles by somebody that I clearly recognized right away. It was astronaut Buzz Aldrin, Edwin Andrew Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon during the Apollo 11 mission. And Buzz greeted us at the threshold of his campsite and said something we didn't understand. He said, "Boys, it looks like you're going to be doing something that I did a few years back, and that's going off planet. And let me just tell you, it's going to be the opportunity of a lifetime." And Brett and I kind of looked at each other like we were hallucinating or something, because this made no sense. But it started to make sense that night around the campfire, because at 10 p.m., and by the way, Buzz Aldrin remained a mentor in Brett Stilling's life for the next 10 years. So he's had much more substantial contact with Buzz. The only contact I've had after that is that Buzz's lovely daughter, Jan, who's a remarkable soprano, sang at my sister's wedding that summer. In fact, I think she actually sang a couple months earlier. She sang the 12th of Never at one of my older sister's weddings in Southern California. So I had some contact with the Aldrin family socially. Anyway, around the campfire that night, Sunday night at 10, my father suddenly stated, "Boys, you're going to be taking some classes tomorrow." And I said, "What do you mean, Dad? I thought we were going to have some fun this summer. I just spent a year in college, my freshman year of college." I said, "No, I'm sorry, son. You and Brett are going to be enrolled, in fact, in some educational program up at the college." Now, the college was the College of the Siskies. And I said, "Really, Dad? What is it going to be about?" And he said, "The seminar is going to be all about Mars, everything you would want to know about Mars." And I said, "Dad, I'm going to be a history major at UCLA in the fall. I already completed my breath requirement in astronomy at UC San Diego, and I'm not going to become an astronomer or an astronaut, Dad. I really am not interested." And he said, "Well, you're going to become interested, son, because you have to attend." And so the next morning, Brett and I looked at each other and thought, "Well, what is going on?" And then I said, "Well, why do I have to attend?" And he said, my father said, "Because some of you kids in the program are going to be going up there to Mars." And, you know, so Brett and I looked at this and like, you know, what have our fathers who have had these lifetime careers and, you know, with reporting requirements to the CIA, basically as defense community engineers, what have they gotten us into? Apparently they've decided that we're going to become astronauts. So it was a very difficult night. I was tossing and turning. I didn't realize I was going to be enrolled in a collegiate program on this vacation. And the next morning, we drove up to the College of the Siskiyous, and we entered a classroom there in one of the bungalows. And the instructor greeted us. That there were about 10 young people, primarily my age. I was 18. I would turn 19 in September. This was about the middle of August of 1980. There were, in addition to Brett and I, there were 7 other males and a female student, roughly centered around the same age, although Brett was younger The female looked a couple of years younger, but the gentlemen were about my age. And the instructor introduced himself as a scientific and technical intelligence officer for the U.S. Army. This would be an Army intelligence officer overseeing scientific and technical matters for the Army. And he told us that his name was Captain Ed Dames. Now, we know Captain Ed Dames today as Major Ed Dames, who's been one of the pioneers of the remote viewing program, beginning later, actually. He claims that he began to work on remote viewing with Ingo Swann in 1982, about 10 years after remote viewing allegedly was pioneered at the Stanford Research Institute. But it was the Ed Dames that we know from his frequent appearances on Coast to Coast AM and teaching remote viewing programs around the world. And he explained that he was simply going to be giving us a briefing about everything we needed to know about Mars, because some of us were going to be going there via a revolutionary jet room technology. Now, I was familiar with the technology because it was the last of eight technologies that I had had contact with as a child on Project Pegasus 10 years earlier. And so Brett and I met up 30 years later in the beginning of 2010, and we began comparing notes about what we remembered, you know, meeting Buzz at the campsite and then going up and being enrolled in this class under Ed Dames at College of the Siskins. We've been able to identify three of the other young people who were participants in the Mars training program, and they were a young African-American gentleman from Hawaii, who had just done a year at Occidental, who, literally in a personal encounter with me, told me that his name was Barry Sotoro. Another one of the young men in the program introduced himself as Willie McCool and said that he was at the Naval Academy and that all we needed to know that he was cool. And he audited the class for about a week and then left and wasn't involved in any other project activities that Brett and I can corroborate. That individual went on and in 1996 became an astronaut in the conventional space program, and that individual is William Cameron McCool, who was the pilot who sadly died when the Columbia was destroyed upon re-entering the Earth's atmosphere very recently, actually. Now, William Cameron McCool was born 5 days after me. He was born on September 23rd. 1961, so he was one of the same age peers that I'm describing. The other individual who we can ascertain the identity of, because we not only interacted with her, but like Barry Sotoro, he became a friend of ours that summer, was a brilliant young woman who had then entered Caltech at age 16, and that was Regina Elvira Dugan, who was a defense engineer. She founded a defense technical consulting firm with her father and his twin brother, her uncle. And on the 40th anniversary of the lunar landing, on July 20th of 2009, President Obama appointed Regina Dugan the 19th director and the first female director of DARPA, literally the U.S. defense agency that had pioneered time travel and that I was serving under as a child in the late 60s and early 70s. Regina would go on to earn a PhD from Caltech, and when we were there in summer of 80, I've ascertained that she was 17 years old because she was born in March of 1963. And the other five individuals remain a mystery. There were two older individuals sitting to our left, sort of between the age of ourselves and our parents, who I think we've identified, but I don't want to identify who they were because they haven't come forward publicly yet. Now, auditing the class behind us were three of our parents, namely my father, Raymond, Brett's father, Tom, and Stanley Ann Dunham, who has been identified as the biological mother and literally the mother in the life of President Obama. I know that it was Stanley Ann Dunham because at the end of the seminar, we had a group dinner at the Creamery restaurant in Weed, and Barry Sotoro and his mother came early. My father was, I guess, back in the car or talking with a colleague in the parking lot or something, and I was standing there in front of the Creamery restaurant, and I asked Barry's mother her name because I had substantial contact with Barry but not with his mom, and she said Stanley, and I said, oh, that's interesting. I have an in-law whose grandfather's name is Doris. Actually, my brother-in-law's grandfather had been given a female name, and here I was in the same time frame, I was encountering an adult woman who had a man's name. And I said, usually a man's name. And she said, it's actually Stanley Ann. I was named for my father. So remarkably, during that seminar, with the exception of Regina Dugan, who I kind of flirted with in the front of the room when the class began, those were the only two individuals that I asked the name of, and they ended up being the 44th President of the United States and his mother, against a background of claims of questions about President Obama's parentage, his nationality, and now we know even his very identity, as Gary Satorio and then as Barack Obama. But as Alfred was able to establish in his research into this, it clearly was the individual who's now serving as president. In other words, I can corroborate that the Barry Satorio in our Mars training course was President Barack Obama. And Alfred can describe how we know that's the case. So in any case, we really just had a factual seminar for 3 weeks. We first stayed together after Brett and I and our fathers left the campsite, you know, the campgrounds there. We were staying with the other participants in the dorms at College of the Siskiyous. And then about halfway through, after about a week and a half, we moved over to the Finlandia Motel in Mount Shasta. And we socialized substantially with Barry Satorio, Regina Dugan, and the other young men in the program. Now, the strange thing that happened towards the end of the program is that Regina, Barry, and I were approached by my father and Ed Dames. And they explained how we were going to teleport to the beginning of the summer because we were being asked to give our opinions in a threat assessment that the CIA was performing about the humanoid civilization on Mars. So Barry and Regina and I locally teleported to June, and then we spent 3 months sequestered working on that threat assessment and delivering literally theses to Ed Dames about what our conclusions were. Barack Satorio didn't reveal to me what he concluded, but I remember interacting with Regina when we were taking our theses to Ed Dames' office and literally meeting him as basically people were turning from a time loop. And, you know, Regina had taken a very hawkish view that she was very suspicious of the motives and the past performance of the humanoids on Mars. And I took a much more unguarded position that we were missing the fact that we were beginning to invade their terrain. Because Ed Dames had explained in the seminar as it was unfolding in real time before we teleported so we could work on the threat assessments, that 97,000 people had already been to Mars. So I was factoring that into my thesis about how we should view the Martian civilization. So that's basically what happened that summer. And then Brett and I had later interactions with Barry Satorio on the surface of Mars. Let me say that there's a dispute in the program as to whether or not it was Mars or some other domain, but it was nonetheless a secret space program. And that's what Brett and I came forward and described in a brilliant article by Alfred in the Examiner on November 8th of last year, and then in our appearance on Coast several days later. So that's really where the story begins. It begins in 1980 in the context of a secret defense technical project focused on the jump room experience, on the jump room technology, and we can corroborate that Barack Obama was one of our classmates.
Well, perhaps this is a good place to pass it back to Alfred and to fill in the detail of the corroboration details. How did you research this, and how do we confirm now that Barry Satorio is the now Barack Obama?
Well, this is really why we've come up with this with the public event unraveling the Obama Mars connection. And by background, I think you may have mentioned that Andy and I are both attorneys, and we're both very much concerned with the constitutional order. I myself have taught constitutional law. I taught the Bill of Rights and constitutional law at the University of Texas. And I was also a cooperating New York civil liberties lawyer. You know, so I'm very much concerned with the Bill of Rights. ironically, one of the sort of high visibility cases that I was involved in was in what they call the Panther 21 trial, in which the Black Panther Party in 1969 was framed by the FBI for a plot to blow up the Statue of Liberty, whereas it seemed that the Black Panther Party was really more concerned with the social welfare of the black community at that time. But as we began to look at this issue, and this will be presented in a full 7-hour event, and will be videotaped, because we really want to bring this to the American people and to the world. There are a number of salient issues. First of all, number one, as to corroboration of Andy, who is a member of the bar of the state of the state of Washington, and who has corroborated all of his testimony with documents and with the congruency of his statements. There are two other eyewitnesses, one of whom has come forward, as Andy mentioned, William Stillings, and another one who will be coming forward. But when we go over to this individual called Satoru Obama and begin to examine that individual, the situation is quite different. Number one, all of these Satoru, I'm going to call him Satoru Obama because there have never been any formal name changes from Barry Satoru, and there are no authentic documents that show that his name is, in fact, Barack Obama. First of all the Satoru Obama birth certificates that exist may, in fact, be forgeries, or they have anomalies associated with them. Secondly, there is, for example, a 22-page analysis of the birth certificate that the president released on April 27, 2011, in a huge show at the National Press Club in Washington in front of one of the presidential candidates, Donald Trump, one of the Republican candidates at that time, Donald Trump, was going forward on an Obama eligibility issue and looking at the birth certificate, asking, well, where is the birth certificate? And at that point, there was a national book by Dr. Jerome Corsi that was about to be published. So he published a birth certificate on live TV in a huge exercise of sort of a PR comedy show, and there have been many analyses of that, one of which is a 22-page expert analysis showing why it is an abject forgery. And not only that, showing why the putative birth date of August 4th, 1961 was chosen precisely because there was an infant girl that had died on that day, that had been born in a specific hospital, that had died on that day. But there are no Hawaii-based physicians, nurses, midwives, nurses' aides that remember the Obama birth, and that is highly unusual and anomalous under the law. And the birth certificate released by the White House is a demonstrated forgery, and we will be demonstrating that publicly at this event. Secondly, there's no DNA evidence has ever established Satoru Obama's paternity. There is no DNA evidence that he is the son of Barack Obama Sr. He could be, he could not be. There are a lot of theories about, you know, alternative theories that are kind of floating around, but there's no evidence as true that. Thirdly, we have a name change certificate in British Columbia dated October 14th, 1982, which is the exact time that Barack Obama was in the Secret Mars program, where there was a change from, and this is in here in BC, a name change from an individual named Barack Munir Ubaid to Barack Hussein Obama. And this is done on 14th October 1982 at the exact time, 2 years into this individual being in the CIA Secret Mars program, at which time he would have already been indoctrinated into what seems to have been another factor involved here. And Andy, perhaps after I finish, can come back on and talk about that. And that is that there's very good evidence that Satoru Obama was pre-identified as a future U.S. president by a secret U.S. time travel program and briefed as such by at least 1982-83, and that this name change in British Columbia on 14 October 1982 was undertaken as part of this future presidency. Now, next, there has never been an official name change from Barry Satoru to Barack Obama. So you're dealing with a lot of, some people might say, oh, that's just legal niceties. But Barack Obama on the Barry Satoru, there's so many legal assumed, so many different legal entities here that it's very, very confusing. And there's an individual whose legal name seems to be Barry Satoru, and then on another hand, he seems to have gone into a secret CIA program and maybe picked up the name Barack Munir Ubaid somewhere in Pakistan after 1980, and then changed it to Barack Hussein Obama, and maybe that's either a red herring, or maybe that was kind of a sidebar, kind of a backup. And so that, legally speaking, we have someone who's taken the oath of office under what's called an assumed name, and also someone who may not be a U.S. citizen. Now, that matter is now going to the courts, and there's a first hearing in a Georgia court after 5 years of trying. That'll be happening January 26th on the issue of whether an individual one of whose parents is not an American citizen can be what's called a natural born citizen. But even there again, we don't even know if Barack Obama Sr. is the birth father of Satoru Obama. And what I found very interesting is that the Satoros Lolo Satoru and Stanley N. Satoru, supposedly Satoru Obama's birth mother, their divorce was filed in August of 1980, which is the exact same dates that Andy talks about, when they had to go into that three-month session to do the Mars threat assessment. So there's a lot of evidence that Stanley N. Dunham was in the intelligence community as well. And so this divorce seemed to have been timed as part of the U.S. secret Mars training. Now, the next issue that we go to is the sealing of all official documentation about Barry Satoru and Barack H. Obama. And what I find very revealing is that the individual in the White House, known as Barack Obama, his first official act of office on January 21st, 2009, was to sign an executive order sealing all documents about him in perpetuity in the National Archives. I mean, isn't that weird?
Wow.
I mean, that is kind of weird. So we have all documents about Barack Obama are sealed. And, you know, let me just get, see if I can get a list of them here. And adoption records, kindergarten records, Punahou School records, Occidental Colorado records, Columbia records, Harvard Law School records, University of Chicago Law School professor records. The Dream of My Father was written by Bill Ayers of the Weather Underground, who was never prosecuted, despite the fact that he was the head of the Weather Underground that did bombings from 1969 to 1972. His medical records are sealed. His entire medical records for 20 years are sealed. And all that he's released is a six-paragraph note from his physician. His Chicago law practice records from 1993 to 2004 are sealed, despite the fact that Tony Rezko, who's a convicted felon, was one of the clients. His Illinois state senator records from 1997 to 2004 are sealed. His Social Security number irregularities are numerous. His Selective Service number irregularities are numerous. Here's an individual who's never registered for the draft, and therefore, if he's not eligible for naturalization. So if, in fact, he's either a Indonesian or a Kenyan citizen, which may be legally the case, he's not even eligible to be an American citizen under prevailing law. And his State Department and passport travel records are sealed. That's a summary on that. Now, that's hardly what we call transparency, and it's very difficult to find out who he is. Now, let's go on some more. Satoru Obama is from a third generation OSS CIA family. His grandparents, his mother, his father, even one of his putative fathers, Obama Sr., came over on kind of a CIA program to have Kenyan activists, kind of the controlled opposition type in Kenya. And Lolo Satoru then became part of the Suharto regime, and while in Indonesia, his mother was part of CIA front organizations there. And when we start examining the career of young Satoru Obama, we discover, for example, that even in his early career, here we have an individual that we know in the 1980 to 82 was in the Secret Mars program. Well, in 83, 84, he worked as editor at Business International Corporation, a known CIA front. So here is someone who has been teleguided through this entire episode. Even, for example, when he was admitted to Harvard Law, his application was accompanied by a letter from Percy Sutton, who was borough president of Manhattan, a very prominent black activist. Where did he get that kind of connection when there's not even a record that he ever went to Columbia University? And Percy Sutton accompanied it by a letter from Khalid al-Mansur saying that this man, Barack Obama, is stellar, and accompanying that with a $20 million donation to Harvard from the Saudi royal family. Now, isn't that kind of, I mean, that is blatantly, it seems to me, out of, not only out of the norm, but can only be accomplished with high-level intelligence connections. Mm-hmm. And then we have Satoru Obama. It's clear that he's being handled and groomed as a covert infiltrator informant, both in the black activist community and in Islamist groups. He goes to Pakistan, and where does he stay? In the presidential palace, in the circles of al-Haq. I mean, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And so here's this person who's being cultivated as the ultimate in CIA legends, who is being groomed in the international jihad, who is being groomed in the black activist circles, who is being groomed as kind of the world president, who was pre-identified, as Andy will say, as a future U.S. president. So it's clear that they're, and who's connected to New World Order circles of the highest order when he's in his early 20s. So I hand the talking stick back to Andy.
Yeah, thank you, Alfred. A major focus of my truth campaign are those things that I feel that the citizens of the United States and that the people of the world deserve to know, not just that we achieved time travel, the U.S. government achieved time travel by 1970 and kept it secret, not only the fact that jump rooms are being used to take U.S. personnel to off-planet domains, but the things that we deserve to know literally as citizens of our constitutional republic. So I've been speaking out about what I know about the way in which the quantum access that time travel technologies allow have permitted the Central Intelligence Agency to do from the time of the emergence of time travel. One of the major things that they decided to do was engage not in changing the future based on prior knowledge of it, which invites its own inherent quantum paradoxes, but engage in contingency planning for future events, basically in furtherance of the continuity of government and the sustaining of our constitutional republic, which is certainly a noble thing to be involved in. And in any case, something that they did that in turn undermined the constitutional process by which we elect the president and the vice president, at a minimum, is approach individuals that they have pre-identified utilizing quantum access as president, as vice president, and apprise them of their future destinies. Presumably because those offices involve a tremendous amount of responsibility and hence a tremendous amount of psychological pressure on the individuals who reach high office. And so it was thought that, well, we won't try to engineer the future, but we will use these new technologies in a way that will be beneficial, and that will be to approach, for example, the president, a given president as a young man, and simply inform them that they were destined for the presidency so that they could psychologically prepare themselves for that mighty destiny. Now, and its inherent pressures and demands. Now, I know this has been done, or was done, with Presidents Bush, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and also with Vice President Richard B. Cheney, because when I was a child serving on Project Pegasus, I was present at lunches at the La Hacienda restaurant in Old Town Albuquerque. After Presidents Bush and Clinton were apprised of their destinies, I was at a lunch where young George W. Bush was going to every table where the project people were dining and joking, "Have you heard? My daddy and I are going to be present." He said it right to my face. So here I am, just to set the picture. I'm 9, 10 years old, and there's a 24, 25-year-old George W. Bush in my face looking like, you know, Alfred E. Newman of Mad Magazine brought to life. He's totally joking in my face. "Andy, have you heard? My daddy and I are going to be president." Okay, so you remember that. I mean, he was the most flamboyant young adult that I met in my entire life at that age. Hmm. And I had some pretty unusual social experiences as a result of a child being involved in a classified defense-related research and development program involving time travel. I mean, I literally met people, unusual people from other times. And yet that was fixed in my mind. I also remember meeting his father, who was a very courteous and rather normal-acting individual, and his mother, Barbara Bush. I literally was sitting there. They were at the next table. Okay. I was also present at a lunch that was attended by my father, Joe Connison, who was another Ralph M. Parsons engineer involved in the time travel program, Dr. Harold M. Agnew, who was then the director, by then he was the director of the Los Alamos National Labs, who was essentially the Federal Science Administrator of Project Pegasus, and Dr. Ivan Browning, who was then the Director of Science and Technology at the CIA. So we went in and we took a table at the La Hacienda, and in walked a young man from Arkansas named Bill Clinton, who, when he was discussing the future destiny that had just been revealed to him by the CIA, by Project Pegasus, was saying things like, "You know, I know you guys are for real. You know, I know all about your incredible feats of high technology as members of the atomic research community. And Dr. Agnew, I've checked you out. I know that you're the director of LANO. But, you know, some days I get up and I pinch myself and ask myself, Bill Clinton, President of the United States, I mean, gentlemen, that dog just don't hark." Okay? So here I'm sitting to the right at the table with a Bill Clinton who was, I don't know, somewhere between 20 and 25 years of age. He was probably still at Yale Law School. Or maybe he had just come back from being a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, but it was a young Clinton. Of course, Bill Clinton was born in 1946, so if this was in 1970, he was 23 going on 24 in spring of 70. And that, again, is the age that I remember. Okay, so I know as a result of my childhood experiences that they had begun this process of apprising future presidents of their destiny. Time travel, in that way, has undermined the constitutional model for selecting the president and the vice president, because the framers of the Constitution could not have anticipated that the time travel would emerge, and they would be able to not only pre-identify, but pre-brief presidents on their destinies, holding those most important offices in our constitutional system. And I know, as not as a constitutional lawyer as Alfred is, but as somebody who swore an oath of attorney in Clark County, Washington, on November 15th of 1996 to uphold the U.S. Constitution, I am, in fact, under a duty, a sworn duty, to apprise the American people of this development, because it goes to the integrity of the constitutional system that I swore an oath to uphold, the Constitution itself. Okay, now the second reason I know that this is being done is because when we were in the training program under Major Gates, and there were many times when my father and Tom Stillings and Brett enjoyed downtime where Ed Dames had called, you know, some kind of recess in our class or whatever. During one episode, Barack Obama went up, or then known as Barry Satora, went up to speak to the instructor, Mr. Daines, who by now, of course, is a major. In fact, the third whistleblower to be coming forward put in a request for Ed Daines' promotion. So I'm going to ask Ed Daines to be a little bit more charitable about what we're establishing here publicly. But anyway, Barry got up, and Tom Stilling said to his son, Brett, how do you feel being in a Mars training program like this with a future president? He nodded over at Barry. And before Brett could answer, my father thrust two fingers into the aisle between our seats there in the classroom and, looking over at me, said, two future presidents. And then Brett had described how in the car going back to, going back to the campsite or the Finlandia Hotel or whenever that discussion was held, he was saying, I can't believe it. They put two future presidents in this class. Why would that be? Okay. So we don't really know if I am a future president, but there's some indication that individuals with links to the CIA, including my father and later people attached to CIA, confirmed that event by stating, yes, Andy, we had also pre-identified you. So I'm coming from a place of humility about that, because we really just have not a formal briefing of me, but my father's statement, and obviously he had a bias, and then other people in CIA who advised me informally of my destiny as president, not in a formal briefing where they sat me down with, you know, Henry Kissinger and Admiral Crow and Barbara Walters or something and just, you know, broke the news to me. I was advised informally that I may one day serve as president. Also, at the end of the year dinner that I mentioned with Barry Satora and his mother Stanley Ann Dunham present, there was a discussion of his future presidency right there during dinner. She was looking over at him, saying, from the context of being a proud mom, looking with a radiant smile over at Barry, saying he's going to be the first African-American president of the United States. And I'm sure that the other young people and several of their parents present at that going-away dinner interpreted that event as simply a proud mother suggesting to her son and others that he was talented enough maybe to reach the White House. She wasn't revealing the quantum access connection, but she was nonetheless stating it. Okay, the dispositive fact that the CIA had already identified Barry as the 44th president of the United States. Now, there was a third incident in which this issue of prior notification of presidents was made known to me. And again, I kind of feel like the hand of divine providence has been operating in my life, because what are the chances of this? I mean, again, I was asked to shoulder an important historical burden that goes to the integrity of our constitutional republic. Because in the spring break of either 1982 or 1983, I narrated this during my first appearance on the coast, I was having a discussion about corporations with a white South African anti-apartheid activist who had set up a card table as a pamphleteer on Bruin Walk on the UCLA campus. I was then a history major at UCLA, and that's where the political pamphleteering goes on the UCLA campus. It's actually licensed to outsiders. And I started talking to South African. He said, you know, your ideas about the corporations are fascinating. I had just interviewed Buckminster Fuller, and I was full of Fuller's ideas about how to create pro-social, you know, sort of universal service corporations that Scott Nearing had initially enunciated as a way to address some of the inherent threats to the political, social, and economic order posed by the transnational corporations. So I was sharing those ideas with this activist. He said, listen, I have a house guest that you have to meet. He would be fascinated with your ideas about the corporations. We drove in his Volkswagen over to a rental house near Bundy and San Vicente there in West Los Angeles, and into the kitchen walked an individual that I didn't recognize as Barry Satora from our Mars training experiences and our Mars experiences, because he was older, taller, thinner, more confident, more intelligent acting, more proactive in his behavior, a better listener. Because the Barry Satora that we had interacted with back in 1980 looked like his high school graduation picture and didn't possess a lot of collegiate demeanor. You know, I almost felt that he was sort of behaving as a high school senior. He seemed a little bit like a fish out of water. But this individual was confident, intelligent, politically committed, and really a very impressive young man. And he introduced himself. I now remembered, and in fact, this didn't enter my earlier descriptions of this event. I think he said at the threshold of our meeting something like, he turned his head a little bit and said, do we know each other, or something like that. I said, I don't think so. And then he introduced himself, and he said, my name is Barack Obama. And we had just had a classmate who had changed her name from a conventional name like Karen Smith or something to Makani Temba and all of the musicality of an authentic African name. And so I kind of teased Barack Obama, and I said, listen, African-Americans are the quintessential Americans. I mean, as distinguished from most Caucasians, half of whom trace their ancestry through Ellis Island. And, you know, the immigration from 1880 to 1924. African-Americans have been on this continent for 400 years. In a sense, they're a fundamental ethnic group in the American, you know, experience. And so I said, I find it a little bit misguided when they assume African names, because African-Americans aren't Africans. They're Americans, and they're the quintessential Americans. Like the, I think I said, like the Native Americans. And he said, mm-hmm. No, man, that's my real name. My dad was Barack Obama Sr., and I'm Barack Obama Jr. But you know something? When I look back at his tone of voice, he was prevaricating. He was saying it as if he had adopted it as a pan-African handle as a black activist, in the way that Malcolm Little, born in the United States, became Malcolm X, in the way that Stokely Carmichael, born in the United States, became Kwame Ture, and in the way that Cassius Clay, born in the United States, became Muhammad Ali. He said it in a way where he really didn't believe what he was saying. He was maintaining a farce. He had adopted a pan-African handle. Okay.
Right.
So those are the three events.
Andrew,
in my life.
Yeah. Pardon me, yeah. But we are getting really close to the hour. This story is so rich and so relevant. And I have so much respect and appreciation for both of you and your courage to come forward and take a stand for the Constitution and to hold true to your integrity of what you know is right. This is such an important message, and I am so grateful that you have been with us here. And we're at the top of the hour. Would you please, in the last few minutes, offer the listeners a way they can find out more information about both of you, and we will be signing off right after that.
Yes, people can go to exopolitics.com, and you'll find all of the background on this story there, and I'll let Andy talk about his websites.
Yeah, I have two websites. I'm at projectpegasus.net, where I am revealing my time travel experiences. And then after I published my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, in December of 2008, I founded the Mars Anomaly Research Society to prove the fact that Mars is inhabited, as we found when we were going up there. And the works of the Mars Anomaly Research Society and our brave and talented team of Mars anomalists is at projectmars.net. And I must say that I'm about 2 years behind at posting media content at my site, so I would also urge your listeners to YouTube my name and pull up some of my radio material, because I'm using radio extensively to reveal what I know and the things that the American people deserve to know.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. And I have enjoyed and learned a lot listening to you and Alfred both. And the thing about you, Andrew, is that you are so consistent. You are so consistent. So God bless your beautiful mind, and bless you too, Alfred. Thank you both again. This is Jameel Graham signing off the Alchemy of Light broadcast on this beautiful Saturday afternoon. Take good care of yourselves. Take good care of each other. And remember, vote for your integrity first. Thanks. Bye-bye.